tweet at TodaySOR.
And lots of people texting as well. 51551. Is Gerard Howland joking? Job seekers receive €188 a week. Would Mr. Howland live on that? Never mind pay tax on it, asks Tom in Wexford. Ministers opponents reported earnings threshold of 47,000. This is from another listener. It neglects the huge difference in childcare costs in Dublin compared to other parts of the country. I was paying over 1,000 a month in Dublin while my friend in Waterford paid 450 for a child of the same age. I am now a stay-at-home mother. TodaySOR@rte.ie if you want to send us an email. Now, there were a record number of complaints made to the Children's Ombudsman. This is highlighted in his latest annual report, this for 2015. The education sector is first and foremost under the spotlight, with strong criticism of how schools deal with allegations of inappropriate conduct or bullying. But hospital waiting lists, weaknesses in child protection and general failings within government are all damaging the lives of children in this country, according to this report. With me now in studio, the Ombudsman for Children, Dr. Niall Muldoon. Thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Morning.
One of the things you say in your report is that it's your view that the autonomy afforded to Irish schools means the government has not been able to exercise the necessary responsibility and oversight. It's time to recalibrate the balance between the autonomy of schools and the oversight by government. Mm-hmm. What prompts you to say that?
I suppose over a number of years now, our office has seen that education complaints have always been the biggest number. And I mean, that's not unusual in and of itself, because there's 900,000 children within the education system. So you would expect that that would be the highest level of complaints. However, what we have found, and what you quote there is our report to the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, we feel that there is a time when the department has to step in to oversee some elements of schooling. We found ourselves in a situation, an example from a case previously was where a young boy, non-national, couldn't get into, he applied to 26 different schools, couldn't get into them. Each school had done right by themselves, followed their own procedures. The Department of Education said they couldn't do anything to interfere with the autonomy of the schools, yet the child was without education. They provided home tuition to him. That was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. That's what led to the Education Admissions Bill allowing education welfare officers to designate schools in those situations. So it's that sort of level of staying out of the situation when a child's right to education has been damaged. There are occasional school boards, principals perhaps, who would ignore recommendations in relation to children's rights, that, you know, you need someone of a higher level to step in. And when the department isn't able to do that, then there is a gap in the rights of the child.
Right, but in that particular instance, there was a legislative remedy found.
It's due to go into legislation soon, yeah, absolutely.
Right. Now, as I said, the biggest proportion of complaints come from the education sector, and no great surprise in that, as mm-hmm. you explained. But you've some interesting case studies, one in relation to a child who took a photograph of another child, used it to bully him, and then you look at how the school dealt with that particular case.
Yeah, this is an interesting case, and again, social media and social media apps are obviously a huge thing that's growing in the last number of years. What we found in this situation was that the school dealt with it relatively quickly. However, the parents came to us with a concern that they weren't informed immediately of the circumstances of the event. Their son went on a school trip, somebody else took a picture and put disparaging remarks up with that picture. The school had dealt with it properly when we went to look at it, and we also then followed up and said to the school, what have you done in relation to communicating with the parents, and what have you done in relation to your policies and procedures, and what have you learned? This school had communicated fairly quickly then. Once the parent had acknowledged their concern, they went back to the parent, acknowledged that they should have spoken with them quicker, but they also went and changed their procedures and policies in relation to social media. They've now in conjunction with the Parents Association, brought in a ban on digital media on school trips. They've also invested in bringing in speakers to talk to the parents and to the students over a regular period of time on internet.
And Niall, safely. Why did that case, why did that complaint reach you?
I suppose what it does is we're available as a last resort in relation to complaints. The parents felt they weren't getting what they needed from the school. They came to us. We will oftentimes, the first thing we'll do is oftentimes pick up a phone and ask the school for their response to whatever the parent is saying. We don't necessarily have to go to full-blown investigations. In this situation, we didn't. We found out fairly quickly how well the school were working on this, and we brought it back to the parents, and the parents were happy with the resolution in the end. And what we do in that situation, all of our focus is on local resolution. You know, every so often we'll publish an investigation, which might have taken 2 years, but most of our work is done in sort of eight weeks
In the area of health, you report on another case, a child whom you refer to as Emily, suffering chronic serious ear and throat infections. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened in that case?
Emily's situation, again, as many parents will know, the sort of scenario of a child having ongoing infections in the ear, nose and throat area. She was required grommets. She was a young teenager. She'd been on a waiting list for over 2 years when her mother came to us complaining. The National Treatment Purchase Fund and HSE had set a target of 1 year on a waiting list for the situation. The hospital involved had tried an initiative in which they outsourced the assessment of some people who were longer on the waiting list. And while they did that, the child was assessed 2 years and 5 months in, but they didn't follow through and offer the treatment through the outsourced consultant. So they then had to come back to a new waiting list, and it wasn't clear if that child had been disadvantaged by moving off the waiting list. So they certainly hadn't done their homework as regards how they would deal with it. Eventually, Emily got looked after within 2 years and 11 months. But in the meantime, she had developed stomach problems because she was taking so many antibiotics. The grommets that were inserted in the end made a huge difference to her hearing, and she's recovering now. But what we found then is that this hospital had also not informed the parent of the possibility of what's called a cross-border directive, which allows parents to receive treatment or get treatment for their child in another European jurisdiction to the same price as they would here. So that option wasn't provided to the parent, which may have alleviated the distress of the child.
People listening to you now and hearing that particular case will say, oh, look, that's the place to go if you're not happy with how long your child is being left on a waiting list. I mean, are you going to get an avalanche of cases or have you had of this kind?
Well, waiting lists are always an ongoing concern for us. However, we're the option of last resort. As an alternative to going to court, people have to go through the local resolution. They have to ask for they have to make a complaint to the local health authority, whoever it might be. And then if they're not happy with that, then come to us. But however, waiting lists, we would continuously look at them and monitor them. But I do believe that there's a lot more initiatives happening in that regard. It's not all about resources. I think, as you can see there, one of the things they did was they tried to have an initiative to outsource the assessment, but they should have followed through with the assessment being followed up by treatment by the same consultant instead of sending it back into a new waiting list. So the initiatives are important.
You have another, I suppose it's a very individualised case here, and I suspect untypical, or at least there wouldn't be too many like it. A case related to the family where a child was effectively denied an identity.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a relatively unique one, but again, it's the idea from our point of view. We're about improving public administration so that the child is at the centre of decision making, and this one really, really highlights it. A young mother who had separated from her husband a number of years, had a new child, wasn't sure of the identity of the father, and had difficulty registering that birth. And with the lack of registration, then she lost child benefit. She lost the ability to put that child on her application for a local housing authority, and the child had no PPS number. So there's a lot of disadvantages in that situation. When we got involved, we found that the General Register Office were willing to allow her to register it in the husband's name because the law suggests that there's a paternal...
There's a presumption.
Presumption of paternity being with the father or the husband. She was willing to do that, but the original local office wouldn't let her do that. She was willing to do that, and we eventually got that to happen because you were allowed to change that subsequently at a later stage, but that allowed the registration. We also had engagement directly with the Department of Social Protection, who were also at a highest level willing to look at it and take on board the facts of the birth without the birth cert being in their hands. So they provided with the proper payments. And again, what we're looking at here is the real example of somebody being willing to be flexible in relation to the child's case. And that's what we're looking for all the time. We're always trying to bring the child to the centre of decision-making for public administrators, not just following the rules and regulations.
Now, something which has been very much in the news of late is Oberstown, the children's detention centre there, yeah. Campus. You've been looking at that. It wasn't fully operational at the end of 2015, but you have one or two individual concerns and cases there, but also some general observations?
Yeah, I mean, one of the cases that we got as regards a complaint, we got an anonymous complaint in relation to a young man we're calling James, who had serious suicidal attempts within the setting, and we went into